Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. We continue this hour with our three researchers on ancient Egyptian technology, Stephen Naylor, new book, Land of Osiris, Chris Dunn, Giza Power Plant, and John Cadman, maritime engineer who's built a working model of a pump based on the subterranean chambers of the Great Pyramid. We've all come together for part two of our discussion to continue just how the solid state machine that the Great Pyramid looks to be would turn water into energy. What we established in the first hour was that Kunkel had the idea that the pyramid was getting water to it, but that's about as far as it went. John Cadman's produced a much more accurate and, very importantly, working model based on the subterranean chambers. Stephen Naylor has worked with Indigenous Elder Hakim looking for those waterways and documents all that evidence of an earlier Nile to the west, so we can date this technology way, way, way back, as Hakim says this Indigenous society says it goes back. We don't need to invoke aliens or Atlanteans. Mm-hmm. Human beings could devise this stuff. And there was the water thus in the way that the water got up to the Great Pyramid. Chris Dunn has looked at evidence for machine tooling in many of the artifacts. Stone balls can't do this stuff. So what were the tools and what powered them? In the last hour, I mentioned Brown's gas because I wanted to make the point that it doesn't take a lot of energy to separate hydrogen and water. This wasn't Brown's gas, however, that this water was being separated into. Chris, you're saying it was hydrogen. And what I was amazed last hour too, John, was when you painted a picture of how simple it would be to bring water up with the right materials, the right chamber, the right pulsing, the right everything, so that the gas naturally separated itself, was funneled up into the Queen's Chamber, and ergo, you didn't have to introduce some outside source of electricity. The materials itself, physics, nature, this was all engineered so that nature would do this process quite naturally. It's stunning.
Amazingly simple design.
Yeah. Do you want to add to that? And I want to hear from Chris. What do you do with a bunch of hydrogen that's resonating at the right frequency? How, you know, to further detail out, and for all of us non-scientists in the audience, take us along on this path as you continue to paint this picture, if you all will.
Oh, is that a question for me, Laura?
General question, whoever wants to take it. I don't mind over-talking. This is a four-way conversation.
Well, you know, Laura, every time we give a presentation on this, the standard 1A question is, what did they use the energy for? People think of only in terms of their modern ethnocentricity. We know we have power plants. We know we have electricity. We know we have devices where we need energy. But people can't conceive of a so-called primitive or prehistoric society having a need for energy.
But there's many points on the electromagnetic spectrum.
Well, I mean,
our form of energy is one tiny slice of it.
Absolutely. But it's a basic question that every biological system, every system that's developed needs an energy input to create itself, to duplicate itself, to continue itself. So energy, you know, again, Chris, we'd like you to address this. What did they use the energy for?
Yes, and I think that what I'd like to say to that, Stephen, I'm glad you brought that up. A lot of, as you can imagine, Laura, I think we go back to 1995, when I was first interviewed by you. But since that time, and especially since my book came out, there's been a lot of detractors of the Giza power plant. And one of the slick comments that people tend to make is, what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Right.
And because the way the book is was kind of advertised, it was, well, what drove the machines? Chris Dunn has developed a theory about the Great Pyramid being a power plant. And
then they're going to say, what machines?
Mm-hmm. And so then they come, okay, well, the machines built the pyramids powered the machines, you know, and so they don't understand the basic concept that we build power plants today, and we use machine tools, and
but
we don't need...
But another concept the ancients had was they enhanced their own biocircuitry, the electrical circuitry of the body. We don't pay attention to that so much unless you go into alternative modalities. You know, the megalithic people used earth energy, I believe, in this way as well. Higher states of consciousness, mystical experiences, being in tune with the web of life, all of that. So if you can find a power output to drive whatever made those drill cores that Petrie talked about, that you document so well, Chris, and enhance your own biocircuitry, then you have harmonious technology, not the mess we have today. But I just wanted to add that point. Christine, please.
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head.
Absolutely.
As far as it was well stated. As far as where my research is taken me, because what I am seeing currently is that they did have a multi-dimensional purposes, the pyramids, not just to provide energy in the form of electricity, power to power whatever devices that they had back then, but also to create environmental changes that a human living within that environment would benefit from.
Well, not just the humans, but look at, you know, growing plants and agriculture.
Sure.
And you know, the birds and the bees and everything else would be enhanced. The very air that you breathe would vibrate to a more life-enhancing frequency. The life force that you live with, the ecstasy you would feel every day.
And the interesting thing is that I had been in contact. I've received thousands of emails over the last 4 years, and one of the most interesting emails that I received and the conversations that I engaged in was with a woman by the name of Susan Alex Gender. And Susan is a composer, and she has worked with a biophysicist who had actually mapped the frequencies of the DNA.
Hmm.
And she contacted me because she had read in my book about the frequencies of the King's Chamber and forming an F-sharp chord, and guess what? They are the same frequencies that we find within our own DNA. So we have this harmonic system that we're a part of. Our bodies resonate to these frequencies. The earth resonates to these frequencies. And there are systems outside of the earth that resonate to those frequencies too. So when everything is in harmony, life is perfect. I mean, how can you know, if you're in tune with your own body, if you're in tune with the earth and in tune with the universe, then you have universal consciousness and connectivity. And I think that the frequencies that resonate with parts of the brain that will actually stimulate certain glands in the brain that would give you a feeling of connectivity with all that is, the universe, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so it is a multidimensional device or devices. And the picture, to me now, is a lot richer than what it was when I wrote my rather technical tome back in 1998.
Well, you know, the whole body is a brilliant machine, and every technology that I think was ever produced is a pale imitation of what nature already does.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can look at the insights of nature, as Victor Schauberger and Tesla and so many geniuses have done, and actually produce that kind of technology, then think how far ahead of the game we would be in terms of enjoying our life while we're busily changing the world and, you know, going power mad and all of that. We could really use power, it's truly meant to be, life force, harnessed life force.
Well, actually, to bring back to a little Egyptology into it, one of the symbols that Hakim was really adamant in teaching me is a symbol called Nefer. I discussed that in my book. The Egyptologists have translated it as good or beautiful, but he came up with the translation harmony. And what does he say basically the Nefer sign represents? It represents our trachea, voice box and the lobes of the lungs. Why? Because he says that's where we produce sound in our body, and that's where we produce harmony. So again, we're saying, and this was brought up in a presentation I gave the other night at a book signing, you cannot divorce the consciousness of the person that's involved with the machine, with the experiment, etc. We know this in quantum physics now, that the consciousness of the observer affects the observed, affects the experience. So that we're talking about people who are in a high state of consciousness using sound through their body to also produce this energy with the machines, with the stone,
we're
to
part
create
of
the harmonious
circuitry.
Effect. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The human element was part of the machine.
So
you can imagine people getting around and toning and ritual and singing and drumming and dancing and the whole thing just part of the activation.
But
and the machine would feed them and they would feed
this. Talk over. One of the misconceptions that I run into, and Stephen can concur with this, is that there seems to be some kind of a dichotomy, if you will, where if you are spiritual, you are non-materialistic, and you eschew technology and industry.
Right.
And if you are a technologist or you're involved in creating technology, then you don't have a spiritual side.
Well, that's the technology as we do it today. It's a good reason to eschew
it.
That's
why it's out of balance.
Yeah.
But it's not always that true. I mean, even the technology, the way...
Well, we are technology,
today.
Right?
Yes.
We have inner technology. That's
correct.
Our human heritage. That's what connects us to higher states. Yeah.
Yes, and I think, though, that the people who are involved in technology on a daily basis should be recognized for their spiritual side, too. Because certainly one thing that I have been faced with is that when we look at the ancient Egyptians, and a lot of people look at the ancient Egyptians as their spiritual civilization that was devoted to their gods and the afterlife, and to imagine that they would actually be engaged in commerce and technology horrifies a lot of people.
I guess I'm not of that.
Sorry?
I'm not of that crowd. So
I know you're not.
Yeah.
You know,
it's amazing how many alternative researchers, that's one of the reasons why they cannot grasp Chris's work, is because they have separatist thinking, and they think that if a people are highly developed metaphysically or spiritually, then they'd have no need for technology. But that's nonsense.
Well, some of the most fun discussions we've had is technology. Does it have to be evil? Couldn't it really be good? And can you find models of nature for technology? And is the human animal just built in order to produce technology? Is this just our fate? You know, birds build nests and other animals, anthills, they build some interesting structures. You know, it's just part of our output. And why can't we do it in a way that is aligned and harmonious and born of spirit? Why can't spirit manifest in our lives through the things that we build and do in our activities? And wouldn't that be this golden age that we all hearken back to, some distant memory? Because I think at one point we achieved it. Was it as tangible as looking at the Giza pyramid as a power plant, as a remnant of this technology? That's so intriguing. Mm-hmm. Can we learn that lesson and apply it today?
I think so, and I think we're heading in that direction, because if you look at the industrial landscape today, especially in England and Europe, and you look at how we practice our commerce and technology and manufacturing today, I mean, if you look into history and make a comparison, there is a huge difference in how workforces are organized and how workforces are managed and how technology is applied. And it's always, throughout the years, there's been a tug and pull kind of, a pull-push kind of relationship between a liberal and conservative. You know, you've got the big business on one side, the liberal on the other side. They want to save the earth, and business wants to make a profit. But I think the results of that have been, industry has been charged with responsibilities to improve their technologies in terms of making them more ecologically friendly. And also,
yeah.
The laws that are applied to industry and to management as they manage a workforce have made them more social, they've given them more social consciousness in terms of how they treat their employees. So it has, it is leading towards that golden age. It's certainly far from it, but
it's the upswing, though.
Vast improvement over what it was. We no longer send 10 and 12-year-old kids down the mines. And, you know, so.
some spirit is whispering in all of our ears, saying there is a better way, and, you know, here's the inspiration to see the pieces of the puzzle, to piece it together, and to put it back on the table, that it's a viable opportunity. Engineers only build what you demand of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many ways of getting to the same goal. You know, physics is very pliable. There are secrets yet to be discovered.
And again, this returns to my work. The indigenous wisdom keepers of Egypt are saying that we're coming to an end of a cycle and going into another cycle, a dawn of consciousness. So therefore, you're going to have, instead of the dichotomy of technologists, engineers on one side, theoretics or metaphysics on the other side, that they are going to come back together because that's how it was. So the golden age in the past can be again. And these two gentlemen that we're speaking to are a perfect example. John Cadman, Chris Dunn, very practical engineers who are very spiritual men, and this is where the future is.
So, enough philosophy. I want to understand and take it from John describing how this resonant pulsed energy being put through the water in the subterranean chamber then ends up to hydrogen and microwaves and the rest of it. Let's understand this technology. So I'll start with you, John, and then we'll switch over to Chris when it comes to his design. Okay?
Well, the basic pulsing is really quite simple.
And we talked about that. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And
and you said the gas would just naturally accumulate on the surface of the water.
And then it would flow to the tunnel going up into the Queen's Chamber.
So the Queen's Chamber would fill with hydrogen. Where would the oxygen go?
Now, that's a good question, and. Truly, my next project that I'd like to do would be to actually build a model with which was made out of limestone and have the same electrical properties. The models that I have right now are made out of epoxy and fiberglass and glass. And truly, I'm not able to prove beyond a shadow of doubt that it produces the hydrogen and oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to build a working model which actually starts pumping it out so I can analyze which gases are being released.
Okay. Limestone's absorbent, isn't it? Tell me about the properties of limestone and how this would work. Does it have any bearing on, you know?
Well, it's electrically conductive. It's also it acts as a contaminant within the water system. And
adding salts and stuff, you mean?
Any sort of contaminants within the water, within like the subterranean chamber, allows for the electrolysis because pure water does not conduct electricity.
Okay.
And by the means of it flowing, it allows for that reaction to occur. And so it's critical to have the same sort of components, same contaminants.
Okay, so so you also have an electrical component here, and the whole, draw a little triangle, and this pyramid's kind of vibrating, all of it, because of the pulsing of this water. This water pulse is strong enough to get this entire, however many ton structure vibrating softly, right?
Correct.
What, you know, give us a beat. What kind of beat are we talking about? How quick is it?
Well, the model runs up. Oh, it's about 100 beats per minute, but.
Well, that's fast.
But the the full scale thing would a lot of it would depend upon the wastegate assembly, which is the the valve down by the Sphinx as far as it's...
How do we know that there was a valve by the Sphinx? What's the evidence for that? You mentioned a waterway. Water could get there, but what kind of a valve are you envisioning?
It's incredibly simple in that it encompasses one moving part, probably a rectangular granite or basalt block, probably 4x4 by maybe 6 foot.
Okay.
And it would just move within a shaft.
Now, I want to ask both you and Chris this. Do you think that there were people that had to go in and daily set registers, work inside the pyramid, go in and out, or was it really a hands-off machine once it was set up and working?
There has the access.
Pardon?
Yeah, hands-off, no access.
No access? I think there was access to area just above the dead-end shaft.
Okay.
I think down into the descending passage, the subterranean chamber would be accessible.
Mm-hmm.
The upper chambers would not be accessible.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And there is evidence that there may be other chambers that led into the subterranean chamber for this accessibility.
Oh.
So again,
okay.
There may have been some tunnels that were not filled with water that were for the so-called engineers to go in and adjust if necessary.
Mm-hmm. And John, what else do you want to tell us before Chris then describes the rest of the upper part of the pyramid and his theory as to how that worked?
Oh, a couple things. One of the nicest things about this particular assembly, the subterranean chamber and descending passage.
Can you speak up?
Is that probably one of the most interesting things is that it's in the dead end shaft. It'd be very easy to tune the pulse rate of the whole whole assembly.
Okay.
Just by having a basic gate type valve. By restricting the flow by a gate valve. At the end of the dead end shaft, it would alter the timing to compensate for water temperature, atmospheric temperature. It'd be extremely easy to do.
Okay, so there were checks and balances along the way. That's what I was getting at. How do you keep the thing tuned perfectly? If it's so powerful, you need to keep it perfectly in tune, and this is how you would do it. Okay.
I believe that would be tuning for the, to create a standing wave in the tunnel going from the pit out to the the Sphinx area.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What else do you want us to know?
I think that's the extent of it, up to Chris's work.
Yeah. Boy, thank you. Thank you, John. Chris, where does it go from here? Say that you got that hydrogen that you based your theory on up into that Queen's Chamber, then what?
Yes, speaking to the tuning, except for any fine-tunement in the subterranean chamber, the mass and the materials of the pyramid would determine the tune, the frequency that it would vibrate at, and there would be no variation. So there would be no. It would be like if you create a bell. And every time you strike that bell, it rings at the same frequency. It puts off the same frequency.
You just need to strike it so that it does put off the correct
frequency. Exactly.
Yeah, so that's where the tuning comes in. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And so it is tuned as it is being created. And then thereafter, there needs to be no more tuning.
Right.
We're talking about the gas, the hydrogen, and... The Queen's Chamber, as I noted in my book, has a... When the early researchers went into the Queen's Chamber, they found it's encrusted with salt, and it was up to an inch thick.
And this would be from the limestone?
And it's...
The water
bleached
that's
from
dissolved.
The limestone. And it was the only area within the Great Pyramid that had such a buildup of salt. They found salt in the horizontal passage leading to the main chamber. And they also found some salt in the subterranean chamber too. But the Queen's Chamber had the heaviest buildup of salt.
So this is what John was saying about the overflow. Water would get up in there and then drain back down and create the circuit, right?
I guess I had a different system working.
Oh, let's hear it.
And that was that they were introducing two chemicals, one from the northern shaft and the other from the southern shaft, because there are characteristics on the limestone on each of the shafts that is different.
That are different. Oh.
Yeah. And the southern shaft, which was explored in 1993 by Rudolf Gantenbrink and the Upuat 2 robot, showed a heavy erosion in the lower part of the shaft. And as the robots climbed the shaft up to the so-called door, where there were two copper fittings, the walls of the shaft are smoothed out. I should note for the listener that this shaft is only about 8 inches square. So the discovery in 1993 seemed to support my contention that they had a liquid in this shaft because it was closed on both sides. Originally, when the pyramid was built, the shaft did not connect entirely with the chamber. It terminated 5 inches away from the inside wall.
And there was some little door at the end that could be raised up, apparently, with a copper fitting.
Well, nobody has ever demonstrated that it could be raised. And the door, I believe, is a misnomer.
Okay.
I believe that it was actually a plate, if you will, of limestone, and it was used to just for the purpose of having the copper inserted into that shaft, and so that they would have a kind of a switch in that area, so that when the shaft was filled with a liquid, there would be a connection, and when the water or the chemical dropped below the level of the electrodes, then there would be a disconnect, and they would call for more chemical to be pumped in. Now that's just a preliminary.
That's brilliant.
Theory.
And let's take a break, and we'll continue with Chris Dunn, John Cadman, and Stephen Mailer. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438.
The Laura Lee Show is brought to you by the following sponsors. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend contains 50 phytonutrient-rich whole foods, whole food concentrates, vegetables, herbs, providing protein, essential fats, minerals, vitamins, and fiber, along with enzymes for ready digestibility. Add to vegetable juice, oatmeal, porridge, yogurt, applesauce, or soups, and can be sprinkled on virtually any food. Call 1-800-243-1438 for a special offer on Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Or for links for more information, go to radiobookstore.com.
Hard to believe that an herb has the power to kill bacteria, viruses, and other pathogens, but the wild oregano growing in the Mediterranean does just that, and as effectively as prescription drugs. Numerous laboratory experiments demonstrate this power, yet oregano is safe and gentle on the body. North American Herb and Spice produces the finest, the purest, the most potent line of oregano products, Oregamax, Oregasin, and Super Strength Oil of Oregano. Read about the numerous lab studies, how to use oregano, and what it can do to protect your health against a wide range of common pathogens and parasites. It's all at oregamax.com. You can also call them direct at 800-243-5242 to place an order or find the store nearest you for your oregano products. A wild oregano, the most potent herb ever tested, yet gentle and safe. It's a great and wonderful gift of nature, and you can call 800-243-5242 and visit oregamax.com. Did you know enzymes are needed for each and every of the millions of biochemical reactions in our body? Past the age of 30, our body's natural production of enzymes slows down. That's why we need to supplement. I take Vitalzyme. It's the most complete and effective blend of enzymes, with protease, serrapeptase, papain, bromelain, amylase, lipase, rutin, and amla. What do these enzymes do? They help so many vital functions. To balance our body's own repair mechanisms, regulate the formation of fibrin, cleanse the blood of debris, promote good blood circulation, maintain immune system health, and much, much more. Vitalzyme contains no animal derivatives, no artificial flavors or colors, and no talc, lactose, yeast, or gluten. For your supply of Vitalzyme and a free cassette of Dr. Will Wong's Systemic Enzyme Therapy, call World Nutrition at 800-548-2710. That's 800-548-2710. Let's continue our conversation with Stephen Mailer in studio, Chris Dunn on the phone, and John Cadman on the phone. And you describing, Chris, how you believe that that Gantenbrink's tunnel, 8-inch square tunnel, was filled with the liquid. And John, Stephen, you were mentioning that.
Well, in fact, I think it was Chris who told me this. We know that Dr. Zahi Hawass, who is now the chairman of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, he's been promoted within the last year. So not only does he control all archaeology on the Giza Plateau in Saqqara, but he controls archaeology throughout Egypt now, has promised that there's going to be a live showing on American television of what's behind Gantenbrink's door. Now, we're all anxious to see that, because since 1993, when the slab that Chris describes was first discovered, he's been promising for years that he was going to go behind the door and reveal it to the world. And
how do you go behind an 8-inch, you know, tube at the end of this tunnel? There's this little door. Do you have to go from the outside of the pyramid to
shift
your way through, or what?
Yes, as you mentioned before, when the pyramid was closed, and I actually got in the pyramid in 1997 and 1998 when it was closed to the public, and we saw distinct evidence that there was some other activity going on in the Great Pyramid besides just a new ventilation system, which was why it was closed. So there is a belief that from the first chamber above the king's chamber, they have tunneled downward to behind, supposedly, Gantenbrink's door, and that they can go in that way. We don't know.
What do they expect to find?
Well, I'm sure Zahi Hawass would love to find evidence of Khufu's burial there, but since it's an 8-inch square shaft, what kind of evidence could that be?
Yeah.
Scrolls, statue, whatever. But Chris has an interesting take about
what's
behind.
It's a liquid feed into this.
Yes,
yeah.
He can describe how he thinks it goes. Chris, tell us what you think's behind the stone in Gantenbrink's door.
Well, in the book, I speculated that there would be a shaft that went vertically to a bedrock chamber underneath the pyramid. Since I wrote the book, I was on the Giza Plateau. Actually, it was the same year Stephen and I were doing our research. And to the east of the Great Pyramid, there is a vertical shaft, and a very interesting shaft that has a vertical shaft with some horizontal shafts running off of it. I hadn't noticed that before. And then also on the southern part of the Great Pyramid, there are similar vertical shafts going down into the bedrock. So I kind of changed my speculation on the bedrock chamber underneath, and I think it's entirely possible that what they were doing was providing the fluid for the king's chamber from the outside of the pyramid, and using these shafts on the outside that eventually connected with the a vertical shaft that went to the shafts that led from the queen's chamber. Now, the interesting thing about that is that there was a French engineer, Professor Carissal, who had detected an anomaly, a vertical anomaly, when he was doing some sounding in the descending passage, and also the horizontal passage, indicating that there was some kind of a regular void that was reach was actually through the through the pyramid and also through the bedrock, which gives me you know, cause to believe that that there is a vertical shaft on the other side of the so-called door.
Now, we've long heard rumors of yet-to-be-discovered chambers and shafts in the pyramid. What does Hakim say about this?
This is an interesting point. He's mentioning the Professor Jean Cadasson, and I have just gotten an email from a French gentleman who's interested in some work in the Great Pyramid, that the French did apply for more permits to do sonic work in the Great Pyramid to find anomalous chambers, and Dr. Huas pulled the plug on it. So Hakim says, yes, there are other chambers in the Great Pyramid, and there are tunnels and different ways going. He's saying there's much more yet to be discovered in the pyramid itself as well as outside. And it's also interesting that Chris mentioned the shafts outside. Egyptologists tend to explain that as trial passageways for building the Great Pyramid, that before they built the pyramid for the descending chamber passageway and the ascending passageway, they did trial runs drilling through the limestone.
Yeah, like you're going to build a solid structure and then put the chambers in. Inside after the fact.
That's right.
Chris,
yes, but David, these shafts were different than the trial tunnels.
I know, and we discovered that. You discovered that yourself in 1999.
Yeah. The casing stones are missing, and who knows what kind of, we were talking about this earlier, apparatus might have been attached to the pyramid via those casing stones. We'll get to that, but who knows what kind of containers there on the outside of the shaft, what it looked like, what other devices. Chris, go ahead. So you think that putting some sort of chemical, the evidence of which you can still see on the sides of those shafts, the chemical composition, into water, into hydrogen?
What I proposed, and I know that Stephen has a different view in terms of how, and he draws on the work of Victor Schauberger, on how water combined in a certain way can create hydrogen. I know that there's electrolysis of water to create hydrogen, and certainly the electrodes at the top of these shafts leading to the Queen's Chamber could be more than just switches. I allow that there could be a lot more than what we what my understanding is or what my beliefs were. But what I base my theory on our hypothesis was that the buildup of salt on the inside walls, the existence of the plate, the unfinished part of the shaft that didn't come through into the chamber, and also the buildup of gypsum inside the shaft itself, where you would have a certain amount of leaching of gypsum when hydrochloric acid would interact with limestone. And also the salt on the wall would be the result of hot hydrogen, which would boil off after the two chemicals combine. There would be a chemical reaction which would result in hydrogen boiling off, and that hot hydrogen on the limestone would create the buildup of salt. So that is basically what when I was doing my research, I limited myself to explain in the best way possible the evidence that was in the Queen's Chamber. And I'm certainly open to consider other possibilities.
Well, as I discuss in my book, there definitely seems to be evidence of what Chris is saying. So I speculate that somehow they may have substituted chemicals for the water for whatever reason, whether the water sources dried up, they didn't have the adequate supplies anymore, and it could be that at the very end of the function of the Giza power plant that chemicals were substituted, because Chris does have some, there is some validity for Chris's work with the salt on crustaceans. But again, my whole purpose is the indigenous teaching that Hakim put two things for me to work on in my research, sound and water. the use of sound, the use of sound for healing at Saqqara, the use of sound to produce the fields to overcome gravity, to lift the stones, and water as the source of the energy. So Hakim was always adamant that water played the key role as the source of the energy originally. But again, it's not an either or thing here. Chris could be right in that chemicals were eventually substituted for the water. But again, now John Cadman's work is supporting the water, that he believes he can demonstrate the water produced the pulsed energy, produced the hydrogen gas that was the initial source of energy for the Giza power plant.
I would like to say that I'm sure it provided the pulse, and I'm not certain about the hydrogen, and Chris could be certainly right. But I know it provided the pulse.
Thank you for pointing that out.
That's great. And again,
we're sure of and what we're just speculating, it's important to
my emphasis was Hakim's insistence on the primacy of water. And
but even if you add a few chemicals to the water, it's still primarily water.
And it's possibly the chemicals could have been substituted. There could have been a desire for more power, for more energy.
Chris, I want to hear your scenario played out here of what do you do with hydrogen? What's so special about hydrogen, the most abundant molecule, atom, material, element in the universe?
Yes,
why
is
that important?
And they say, it's the most basic element. It has one proton, one electron, and it's the most plentiful element in the universe. The reason why hydrogen resonates with me, if you'll excuse the pun, but it's because it does resonate with the universe, and it also, the frequency resonates with the Great Pyramid.
So it seems to be designed for hydrogen because it's designed around the same wavelength.
Because of the wavelength,
that hydrogen
exactly.
Has. Okay.
And it's that wavelength that we find in the King's Chamber.
What is the wavelength?
It's 21 centimeters, 8.309 inches. And that wavelength we find in the northern shaft in the King's Chamber. This shaft pierces the pyramid structure and comes in on an angle from the northern face, with a few bends, and then it enters into the King's Chamber. The dimensions of the shaft are 8.4 inches and 4.8. And so when we look at dimensions that would be suitable for a wave guide, because to carry microwave energy, which is, electrical energy, electromagnetic energy, but to carry it, you would not use a solid wire. You would use an open wave guide, and the dimensions of the wave guide would be the width would be the wavelength, and the height of the rectangular shape. The height would be approximately half the wavelength.
So if you're pulsing hydrogen, you've got microwave. How do you get get microwave?
Okay. When hydrogen is pumped to a higher energy level, the electron moves to a higher orbit. I'm trying to explain it as simple as possible.
Uh-huh.
That electron, which circles the atom, circles the proton, the electron is like a spot on a balloon, if you will.
Okay.
Okay. So you're pumping energy into the hydrogen, just like you are blowing up a balloon.
And the pumping energy is because the whole pyramid is resonating.
Because the whole, the pyramid is resonating.
It's vibrating.
But also there is other activity going on inside the King's Chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And in the King's Chamber, what you find is a structure that is quite remarkable. Your previous guest, John Reed, talked about the acoustics of the King's Chamber. These are critical. Tom Danley, in 1996, I believe, determined that the King's Chamber is still resonating at an F-sharp chord.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is an acoustical phenomena within this chamber, but we also have a chamber that is constructed entirely of granite. And granite has different properties, electrical properties, than the limestone, which comprises the bulk of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
The granite is comprised, this particular granite is from Aswan, which is 500 miles away, and that could be a topic of another conversation.
Why bother to bring it in?
how they quarried the thousands of tons of granite and brought it 500 miles down the Nile. You know, some of the blocks weigh 70 tons or more. But the granite is comprised of 55% silicon quartz crystal. And also, when you look
silicon quartz crystal, computers, radio,
diesel, yeah, electricity.
It's actually called rose quartz granite because it's rose quartz.
But the structure above the King's Chamber is probably the most remarkable structure that you will find. And what we have are five layers of these giant granite beams. They're 27 feet long. They weigh up to 70 tons each, and there's over 43 of them.
So if you were looking at it as a technology, what would you describe it as?
Well, some people look at it and they think of dielectric resistors or capacitors or something of that nature. What I see it as is just an amplification chamber where each beam is tuned to a specific frequency that is in harmony with the frequency of the chamber itself.
So you get overtones and you get a whole range? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What's important about overtones?
You can take a frequency at a lower frequency, and then through a series of harmonic steps, you can raise that frequency higher and higher. And so this process was occurring constantly within not just the Grand Gallery, but in the King's Chamber and above the King's Chamber, because that energy would transfer from one of the beams to the next level and all the way up the series of beams to the top.
Okay.
Just like the piano string.
So you wouldn't lose energy as it's traveling. You're actually amplifying it and expanding its bandwidth.
Well, it is tuned to the same frequency as the forcing frequency, if the medium is tuned. Now, we'll call the beam a medium. If that's tuned to the same frequency or a harmonic of that frequency, of the forcing frequency, then it will maximize absorption of the energy. And then it will vibrate in sympathy with the forcing frequency. And so what you have then is a mighty transducer. And you know, you talked about Casey early on, and you talked about the mighty crystal. And I read a little
bit. The mighty crystal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What we have inside the Great Pyramid is a mighty crystal. But it was done with natural materials. And there has been absolutely no explanation to satisfy the evidence when it comes to explaining why they had five layers of beams. They call them relieving chambers.
Oh, for the pressure. You don't go to all this work without a very good reason.
Well,
for
Chris,
it.
They don't relieve any pressure.
Chris has been the first engineer to actually write in print to state that those five chambers are redundant, if you're calling them relieving chambers, as he's going to say.
Well,
they're not relieving the pressure.
Maybe they're placed such so that they do help the structure hold together. I don't know. But they also would serve as what you're talking about, tuning fork.
They don't have any structural benefit at all.
Okay, let's get that on the table.
Okay.
Not relieving chambers.
Maybe when they were building the pyramid and they didn't have any porta potties, but
So you're saying a transducer, it's taking the resonance and the power and it's putting it into this chamber of hydrogen? It's tuning to hydrogen?
And
let's also define, what is a crystal? A crystal is any matrix that's regular and that has energy flowing through it in a particular fashion, right? What are the properties of crystal? Crystal, we think of liquid crystal matrices, and, you know, we can expand our definition of a crystal beyond its crystal.
Yes, I mean, a quartz crystal is known to have piezoelectric properties.
What is piezoelectric? What does that mean?
Well, it's a conversion of, or transduction, or transducing one energy to another energy. In other words, if you excite a crystal mechanically, by compressing it, alternately compressing it, it will produce electricity.
It produces a coherent electrical charge.
And likewise, if you put an electric charge on a crystal on a certain axis, it will produce sound.
You know, the universe is very adept at using and transmitting and receiving energy. So are our bodies. We just have to kind of catch up here to the concept.
Mm-hmm.
Nature has been at it a long time.
Yes.
With all of these materials and how easily it flows through physics.
Mm.
Okay.
It's what Pythagoras called the harmony of the spheres.
Mm.
Sound is what is through the universe. If you take the beginning of the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. If you just substitute in the beginning was the sound, and the sound was God, that's the basis of creation to a lot of people.
Frequency. Mm-hmm.
Vibration.
Yeah. Okay, so then what, Chris? So you're transducing this pulse and this amplification of energy into hydrogen. Then it's got this correct wavelength. It's the same wavelength as the hydrogen, so it doesn't lose energy as it goes up and it's being shot out the sides.
What we have is if we excite the gas within the chamber and then pump it to a higher energy level, just, you know, mm-hmm. I was using the analogy of a balloon, then we are setting up the conditions where a stimulated emission of radiation can occur, and what we have essentially is a maser, which is a microwave amplification through stimulated emission radiation.
That's what maser stands for.
And that's what maser stands for.
So
actually, the maser was the precursor to the laser,
mm-hmm.
and I feel sound like Austin Powers now.
and it is believed that Nikola Tesla invented the maser.
Mm-hmm.
But the laser was actually first called the optical maser when it was first invented.
Because it's doing it with light.
With light.
But you could do it with other
microwaves.
Other emissions from the electromagnetic spectrum. Okay.
So what I envision, and you know, there's a lot of materials that I'm missing, but the technology that I envision was because of the evidence that's there, because of the dimensions of these shafts, the evidence in the Queen's Chamber, the Grand
mm-hmm.
Gallery. Grand Gallery.
Brilliant.
What we had was hydrogen in this chamber that was being pumped to a higher energy level. Then we look at the northern shaft, and the dimensions of the shaft lead me to speculate that there was a signal coming into the chamber from the northern face, and that signal was actually a hydrogen microwave from the universe. And
because that's the background radiation
of
the universe at large.
Mm-hmm. From the Big Bang.
Would there be some sort of collecting device, like a satellite dish, perhaps, on that end?
There could be.
Who knows attached to those casing stones?
The sides of the northern face could have been treated, possibly, to collect that.
Well, the whole sides are indented slightly,
they're a little bit concave.
Dish-shaped, yes.
Dish-shaped, yeah. The whole sides of each.
All four sides.
Yeah.
And so that input signal, if you go from the northern shaft and follow the direction of the northern shaft across the room,
mm-hmm.
in the southern wall, you'll see a large opening. And the shape of that opening is like a horn antenna. And I
what is a horn antenna?
Well, if you go drive down the highway and you look at these communication towers, you'll see some of them have these antennas that are shaped like a catcher's mitt. And those are what they call
What's special about that shape then? Why does that work?
It collects radiation and focuses it to a small spot. So it takes it over a larger area and then focuses it to a waveguide that is actually a smaller dimension.
So you're saying the north side and the south side were
entirely different, but
coordinating the transfer.
Yes, because once the microwave beam enters the King's Chamber
mm-hmm.
and starts traveling across the room and interacting with other devices that would be in its path to amplify it even further.
Right.
And I think, Chris, we should point out, and this was verified by the work of Sir Flinders Petrie, that the stone box in the King's Chamber is not in its original position, that it was originally between the openings of the shaft, and it has been moved.
That's where I speculate that.
Okay, let's talk about the granite box. Mm-hmm. It's got, now John Reed was pointing out that its dimensions were also in harmony with the chamber at large.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would its function be in this scenario, Chris?
It could have, it could have served as some form of amplification.
Do you think it was filled with something?
It could have been filled with something. It could have had something within the box. The interesting thing about these ancient Egyptian boxes is that the precision on the inside surfaces are quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they were crafted to accept something else, though whatever that something else is not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But if I take you into the pyramid next door, into Khafre's pyramid, the corner radius is almost a sharp corner in that particular box, in that pyramid. And there's no real reason for that, unless you're putting something in there, because the amount of work it would take to sharpen
right.
that inside corner,
how do you get little pounding rocks to do that? We've got 2 minutes, and I need a summation. Chris, what do you think what they were doing with this, you know, putting a person in the sarcophagus to go, I'm in touch with the universe in a very harmonious way in that background radiation of the universe at large. What were they doing, and how do you get power to operate these tools that created those precise inner corners? 1 minute, and then I've got 30 seconds each for John and Stephen.
Well, I think I relate back to your original comment that the upper chambers were inaccessible and probably inhospitable, too, to any human body because of the energy levels. The power
and chemicals. And chemicals.
And chemicals. The power coming out of the king's chamber. The interesting thing on the southern shaft goes out of the king's chamber at a 45-degree angle. It crosses the equatorial plane almost at the point where you would park a geosynchronous satellite. And I know that that is really, really far out. And a lot of people are going to, you know, roll their eyes at that. But
you're just making an interesting notation here.
It's an interesting notation.
Make the implications as you will, but you're just noting that. So you see a vast array of technology supported by this solid-state machine known as the Giza Pyramid.
I see that if they can build a pyramid, if they can craft their artifacts in the manner that they did, there is a lot missing. And it's open to interpretation. And when we look at the how we craft these artifacts today and the level of technology that we have to engage in to craft them, then it does open up a different view of the ancient Egyptians or the ancient Chemetians.
And who knows where those tools are, those other apparati,
I think
where they're buried.
Yeah, I think then we have to look at the time period that the pyramids were built or when the tools were used.
That's where Hakim comes in, too.
Yes.
If we're looking at tens of thousands of years, then they probably wouldn't have lasted.
So we can explain their disappearance. John, I want to say thank you to you and your comments.
Why, most welcome. I mean, it's good talking to everybody, Chris, Stephen, and of course you, Laura.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
It's great talking to you too, John.
Yeah, and thanks for your participation here, John, and just the wonderful work that you're doing. Stephen, we sum up with you.
Thank you so much, Laura, for bringing us all together and to be able to present our work to the public. It's a great work that you do.
Again, we have links to all of their websites and their books, and the trip that is upcoming. And I just want to say in the short time remaining, thank you all, and thank you for listening. And as we go forth and sort out these puzzles, we will open a whole new chapter in